my friends are gone and my hair is gray. I ache in the places where I used to play, and I'm crazy for love, but I'm not coming home. I'm just paying my rent every day in the Tower of Song. I said to Hank Williams, how lonely does it get? Hank Williams hasn't answered yet, but I hear him coughing all night long. Oh, 100 floors above me in the Tower of Song.
Community Radio 3CR, streaming live on 3cr.org.au. This program is a podcast.
I'm afraid Dale's been gender reassigned this afternoon. We don't have Dale, we have Andy. What are you doing here? You didn't know you have to speak, did you?
No.
This is a program where we expect you occasionally to say something,
Andy. Okay. I'll do my best.
Yeah, well, you know, your job is very simple. Your job is to protect the guests from unwarranted slurs.
Okay.
So if I go over the line,
I'll let you know.
You just come around and whack me across the head.
Okay.
All right?
Yeah, I think that's the way it works. Dale do that before.
Yeah. Dale's done that before, so we feel all right. Now, our poor guest, Annette Kelly, must be wondering where she is. Now, usually we have a different person who does all the technical stuff and asks the equational question, but obviously Dale's indisposed today, and we've got Andy. I don't know how he'll cope.
Oh,
he's young. What do you reckon,
Annette?
I think
he's just gorgeous.
You just think he's just gorgeous?
I'll take that.
Okay. He'll cope if you call him gorgeous. His name's not George.
Okay.
It's Gorgeous Andy. Doesn't kind of rhyme, yes. You know?
I'll try
How about the apple of your eye,
I'll
Andy?
I'll try and remember that, Andy.
Yeah,
yes,
Andy.
That's okay. I will do that.
Now, Annette, this is a great radio station, but this is the best program on 3CR. You know why?
No.
Because it's just you and me, no ads, no community announcements, no music. And we've got to fill 55 minutes. What do you reckon?
Oh, well, we'll try.
We'll try. And we only ask 2 questions.
Okay.
Did you know that?
Yes. Oh, you ask away.
Yeah,
yes,
well, yes. The first question, just to orientate our listeners, what year were you born?
In 1940.
Would you like to repeat that?
In 1940.
1940. 40. Now, my arithmetic is very bad.
That makes me 76.
76?
Yes.
76. That's okay. Mm-hmm. You're one of the youngsters we've had here. We've had people in their 90s in this studio.
Oh, you're right.
Yeah, so you've got another 14 or 15 years to go in it. At least.
Don't tell me.
Now, Annette, and then that's your first question. It only took 10 seconds. The second question takes 55 minutes and 46 seconds to answer.
Okay.
So you ready?
Yep.
All right. What's the earliest thing you remember?
Well, I've got a good memory of two things that
I
remember.
Yes, tell us about them.
Now, when a baby is a baby, they aren't aware of themselves, right? And the way that a psychologist finds out when a baby is aware of itself is to put a red dot on the baby's nose and show the baby a mirror. Mm-hmm. And if the baby touches its nose, it's aware of itself. And if it touches the mirror, it's not.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I obviously was not aware of myself until one day when I, with my mum, I walked up to our front gates, which weren't very high, and I was looking up at them, and I suddenly had this sensation that there was a barrier in front of me, and suddenly I was flooded with this sense of myself. I was a person in the world, separate from everybody else, and it was so frightening that I could remember clearly And I don't remember walking up to the gate, but I remember this. And I ran screaming back to my mother, who must have, to the day she died, wondering what on earth was the matter with me.
That was
the first one.
And the second one,
my mum's older sister lived in the city. She lived at number 9 Queen Street. Mm-hmm. Which was the Felton Bequest building.
Very nice building.
And she was the caretaker there. And she was staying at our house in North Bourne. And, of course, we had a bath. And in 9 Queen Street, they didn't have a bath. So my Auntie Tilly, whom I loved dearly, was having a bath. And Mum was standing at the end of the bath chatting to her sister. And I suddenly had this impulse that, you know, people washed other people's backs, you know, and I was going to wash my Auntie Tilly's back. Now, I was right down at my mother's knees. That's how small I was. Right. And I pushed and I pushed and I pushed. And my mother was a little lady, you know, a little fine-boned lady, and she sort of buckled. And I grabbed the face washer and started washing my aunt's back. And that's another memory. So I must have been very small when that happened as well. Yeah.
Oh, they're lovely memories, aren't they?
Oh, but that aunt only, well, she died, must have died when I was 3 or 4. But I still have, you know, marvellous memories of her and the love I felt for her.
Over 70 years later, you've still got the same.
Oh, well, I was talking to one of my cousins who's about 8 years older than me, and she said, "Oh, I love Tilly too," and her eyes filled with tears.
Right.
And I had lovely stories about Auntie Tilly. Can I tell you this one?
Yeah, sure. It's your hour.
Oh, you're right.
You can say what you like.
Well, my cousin, Patty, we called her. She was a child, and she went with Tilly on a train to, oh, they went to Harrietville, but I think the train might have just gone to Bright.
Right.
But anyway, at Flinders Street Railway Station, my aunt was buying all sorts of things, and Patty was saying, what are you buying all these things for? And Tilly said, "Now, you'll find out eventually." And so they hopped onto the train together, and as they reached the countryside, people apparently would come to, I'm presuming this is the late 30s, people would come to the side of the, you know, when the train slowed down, maybe, and they would call out, "Papers, papers, backy, backy," tobacco.
Right. Yeah.
And, of course, people in the trains would throw these things out.
Right.
And so then Patty became aware that this stuff was to throw out, you know, that Tilly had bought. But Tilly said, no, not yet, not yet, not yet. You just wait. And so, you know, people threw everything out. And then when the last thing was thrown out, then it was Patty's turn. And so it was so that the people at the end of the line would get something.
Right.
You know, and I thought that was incredible.
So this was a depression thing, was it?
Oh, I'd say so. Over the end of the, the depression was what the early 30s, wasn't
it?
But, I mean, I think it was a pretty bad time, really, wasn't it?
Yeah, well, if you were born in 1940 and she was 8 years younger, it'd be about the mid-30s.
Eight years older, in the mid-30s. Yeah. Yes, I think it was.
So it was a way of people who could travel actually paying, giving back to their fellow country people.
Yeah. Yes. Well, I mean, I don't think they were wealthy people.
No.
But that side of my family were definitely activists.
Well, you wouldn't see it today, would you? You know, you get people coming up to you asking for a shilling or 10 cents. You tell them to piss off.
Oh, I give them some money.
No, I know you do. But a lot of people just kind of shake their heads. And
well, sometimes you haven't got any money because we've got our cards now.
But I'm just saying, this is quite an amazing story. I've never heard this, the fact that people who are travelling by train, just ordinary people,
would
buy all this stuff and then they'd throw it out for nothing.
They would just have it, because you'd buy a paper because you're going to be on a train and it's pretty boring and, and you'd have stuff, I suppose. I don't really know. But the fact that my aunt, maybe other people did it too, I don't know.
Right. Were you born in Melbourne or?
I was born in Coburg, in the Sacred Heart Hospital, in the middle of a freezing cold climate, thing.
Yeah.
It was 15 degrees the day I was born. Apparently.
What month?
October.
October. We won't give you a date just in case we've got people who want to steal your identity out there, you know. and at Kelly, a very common
name. It's Cully, by the
Cully.
Way. Cully.
C-U-L-L-E-Y.
Cully's not my... My maiden name was Donovan.
Donovan.
Yes.
I like Donovan better.
Yes, I do too, yes.
Well, we'll call you Annette Donovan.
But the Cullies apparently...
No, let's go back. Let's go back.
Yes.
What was your mother's name?
Kathleen Donnelly.
And Dad?
Frank Donovan.
Right. Yeah. And where did they come from? Were they born in Australia?
Yes. Dad was born in Ballarat. He was born on the goldfields, I think.
Right.
He was born at a place called Ellendale.
Yes, which, I know Ellendale.
But
yes.
It doesn't exist anymore. No. It was a gold... And Mum... I don't know. Lived in Richmond.
They
lived in Richmond. My grandmother, my maternal grandmother, was very much of an activist,
mm-hmm.
and she married the son of a convict, actually.
Right.
So my great-grandfather was actually a convict.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm sure people think that's a bit strange, but...
Stain on your character. That's what it was like in the 50s and 60s, and now it's royalty.
Oh, it's, yes. Well,
now you're Australian royalty.
Yeah, you think it's wonderful.
Isn't it amazing how things change? Because people used to hide all that.
Well, they did. Yes,
yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, I was ashamed of it.
We always knew that there was a convict in the family, and that he came from Ireland. He came from Sligo.
Mm.
He was accused of stealing turnips, and I think he might have been in a syndicate that stole turnips.
Right.
Because when I looked in the Sligo records, his name was bracketed with about six other people, and with ditto for stealing turnips.
Yeah, some people steal cows. Your ancestors stole turnips and they got transported.
No, he didn't get transported for that. He got transported for trying to break out of Sligo jail.
Ah.
And that's why he was transported.
Although we're laughing, I mean, these were tough times in Ireland when people were starving to death.
Oh, yes.
They were starving to death, and you can understand
that. If you want to steal a turnip, you'd have to be pretty hungry.
You know the suburb of Tullamarine?
Yeah.
You know who that's named after?
No.
That's named after an Aboriginal resistance fighter.
Yeah, right.
In the 1840s.
Mm.
And his crime was stealing potatoes.
Oh.
See? So you've got a lot in common there.
Oh, that's just... that's horrible, isn't it, really?
Yeah.
Yes.
We laugh at these things, but we don't actually think of the background of that particular... The people were starving and they needed food.
Exactly. Yes, yes. Yeah. Well, he went to Tasmania he... worked there as a boatman. He'd obviously had some connection with the sea,
right?
Because he had something called a foul anchor tattooed on his arm, which was apparently a sign that you're a seaman. Plus, he had his initial on his finger, M for Martin.
Yeah.
But he couldn't read or write, and he married a free Irish woman, and he had one. I think they had a baby that died actually, and then my grandfather. And then he actually died, and she remarried into a lovely Melbourne family called the Healys.
Mm-hmm.
I've met Healys. They were very nice people.
Did you know Evelyn Healy?
I don't know.
Not sure.
No, I don't know.
No.
There might be a lot of Healys around.
Well, there are
I'm
a lot
quite
of Healys.
Sure.
Yeah.
But I think some of them played football here. So
did
that's
they?
And
the reason I asked is that the guest speaker at the Reclaim the Radical Spirit of the Eureka Rebellion celebration we're having this year in Ballarat on the 3rd of December. It's Dr. Anne Sunter-Beggs, and she's talking about Evelyn Healy, an unknown Eureka, an unknown Eureka supporter in the 50s.
Right.
So maybe
maybe
it's the same.
Well, they
the
were Ballarat. Ballarat area.
May have been the same crew.
Yes.
Well, we'll find out on the 1st.
Well, my father's family were involved in some way or another. The Costellos and the Donovans were involved with, apparently. But we don't know much about it, really. I don't know.
Why? So, would you grow up in Richmond?
No, I grew up in North Baldwin.
In North Baldwin.
But
so
they were Brunswick.
You...
The Donovans were Brunswick people, and the Donnellys were Richmond people.
Oh, and my twain shall meet.
Well, my grandfather, though, Ned Donnelly, he was involved with the unions very, very strongly involved with the unions. And I think my grandmother, another little story. Mm. My mother was a little girl and she was skipping in Queen Street.
Right.
And,
As you would,
yes, in those days, And while her mum cleaned 9 Queen Street.
Yeah.
And a lady came up to her and said, "What's your name, little girl?" And my mother said, "My name is Kathleen Donnelly And my mother is a life governess of the Austin Hospital. Oh, dear. But, yeah, so they were. She was very involved with...
So did your mother know Mrs. Austin, did she?
No, no. The Austins... The Austin Hospital was apparently founded by women.
Yes, no, it was founded by Mrs. Austin. She gave the land.
Well, it's a woman. Women were involved, obviously.
Because it was set up as the hospital for the incurables.
Oh, was it? Oh, I didn't know that. No.
Yeah, and she donated the land in the 1890s.
Mm-hmm.
And it became the hospital for the incurables. Everybody who had... Because there were a lot of people with incurable diseases.
Oh, well, yes, really
and
bad.
And so they're all
basically
shunted to the Austin.
Yeah, right.
Up till about the 50s, late 50s, early 60s, when then it became a general hospital. So there is something in the title that, one, the government can't sell the land, and two, that the name Austin is to be attached to that land.
Oh, yes,
so
okay. Well, they were
Austin. So the fact that she was a life governess is quite interesting. Your mother was a life governess.
Well, I don't know anything about it, though.
I mean, because that's a very, very important position in the community.
But she wasn't... They weren't wealthy people.
No, you didn't have to be wealthy.
No.
Did you have any disabled people in the family? Maybe that's how she got involved with the Austin?
No, I don't think so. I think she... Well, somebody told me that she... delivered babies, laid out bodies, and arranged wedding feasts, and that was a family very connected with cleanliness.
Right.
So you see, that was very important. If you touched, bodies, and then you delivered babies, you had to be very clean, or the mother would die of childbed fever.
That's right.
And that was, so that side of the family.
You don't hear that word these days, childbed fever, do you?
No, but when I was at university, was doing history and philosophy of science, and I just didn't know. I just had three children, and I'd had dramas after the last one, Mathoric collection, funny things happened. And I didn't know what to write about. You know, I was in a terminal state of indecision about everything. And Ding Dyson, who was the person who was in charge, was the reader in the history of philosophy, suggested that I look at person called Philip Ignaz Semmelweis,
and he 1864.
Yeah, okay, yeah.
Dr. Semmelweis.
It's fascinating.
He changed 1,900 years of medical practice, because Galen.
Yeah.
Galen. Yeah, he was a very important Roman physician.
Oh yes, right.
Noticed that wounds healed when they pussed. When there was pus.
Oh, yes,
so what happened on all the battlefields for the next 1,900 years in the Western world is you would rub dirt and feces into open wounds in order to get pus. Because that was a sign of healing, it was felt. Now, Dr. Semmelweis, who was part of the Prussian Empire, he turned that idea on its head in 1864 because... The city, I'm not sure what town they were in.
He was Hungarian, was
Hungarian,
he? Not Hungarian.
Was he?
I think so.
They actually, the council had set up this brand new hospital for women to deliver.
Oh, yes, right.
This is the new, new thing. But all the working women refused to go there because the mortality rate in the hospital was greater than the mortality rate from home births.
That's right.
And they were dying of fevers. They were dying, as you said, childbirth fevers.
Mm-hmm.
They were dying And Semmelweis worked out at this time, and this is when microscopes were being invented, that there were bacteria.
Yeah, right, yep.
And that it was the bacteria that was causing the fever. And he was the first one who recommended that people wash their hands.
That's right, yes.
So did you do a thesis on Semmelweis?
But he did, it was undergraduate stuff,
Right.
But I think the problem was that he only spoke his own native language. Yes. He was finding it very difficult to communicate with, other people.
Yeah.
And so, I think he had a difficult... I can't remember all the details now, but he had a difficult time, and I think eventually he actually caught that himself, that disease, and died of it. Yeah. So it was his life was a bit of a tragedy, I think.
Well, it was, but he was the father of modern medicine.
But he was the father.
He changed 1,900 years of people going down the wrong path.
Yes,
Semmelweis,
that's right.
And he is remembered because he's very important in my medical training, Dr. Semmelweis. I'm sorry for...
Well, no, that's all right.
I thought you raised him and you did some work on him.
That's fine.
Now, going back to your life,
Yeah.
Where did you go to primary school?
I went to St Bede's in North Bourne.
Aha. What was that like?
Well, it was in an old, well, not old, but it was in a little church building.
Mm-hmm.
And so when they weren't saying Mass, we had school all the week and there was two classrooms.
Two classrooms.
one was prep grade one and grade two and... I think, and then three and four, and three and four was taken by a very elderly nun, an Irish woman called Mother Melkus, and I don't think she managed to teach us much, but the one before, the prep grade one, the classroom was taken by a young nun, Sister Saint Stephen, and she became a family friend, and my mother, wherever she went off to Western Australia, I think, and might have become head of the order, I can't remember, but Mum used to write constantly letters to her. Mm. She was wonderful. She let us do things, whenever anyone came to the door, for example, she'd be involved in a conversation, obviously, and we knew that there was a cupboard full of tapestry-covered cushions, and out came those cushions, and they were thrown around the room with great vigour, and we became wonderful readers of body language.
Right.
And we'd watch her, and we'd get, as her conversation came to an end, back would go all the cushions into the She never said a thing.
Was it a mixed school or a girls' school?
It was boys and girls. Yeah, it was at that stage, I went to school, you wouldn't believe, with the Santa Marias.
Right. I would believe that.
I remember Bob Santa Maria very well. He was the most self-effacing little man.
Yes.
He wasn't as you would imagine him,
No, but that's what happens in life. People go in different directions. That's the whole purpose of this program. By the time you finished primary school, did you think you had any special gifts or interests?
I read a lot.
Mm-hmm.
I read five books a week.
A week?
Yes.
In primary school?
I guess so. We didn't learn to read quite
they should
really
have closed
early,
the libraries.
Did we?
They should have closed the library, shouldn't they?
Well, they had a little library in North Bourne, and it was run by two English women, a mother and a daughter, the Coatesmiths, and they were very encouraging of us read, read a bit something a bit better, because how we had Enid Blyton and Biggles and all that sort of thing. So
Fabulous Five.
I read a lot, and my mother would let me read anything. She let me read a book called The Well of Loneliness.
The Well of Loneliness in primary.
I wasn't primary then. I think I was probably a bit older by then. But she never said, you can't...
No.
I didn't realise it was about lesbians anyway. I didn't know. You know what I mean?
Yes.
It all went over my head, and Mum probably thought it would anyway.
Yeah.
And she wasn't narrow-minded, my mother.
Right.
She was,
how about Dad? Did you have any brothers and sisters?
Yeah, a brother and a sister, yes.
Did your Dad take much interest in what was happening in the house, or he left that to Mum?
How do you mean?
Well, did he take part?
Oh, Dad, yes. He was an SP bookmaker.
Oh, that's good.
A larger-than-life character.
He didn't use his kids as cockatoos, did he?
Oh, well, at one stage we used to have to sit out the front and look out for the cops. Yes,
yeah, you
we
were
did.
Cockatoos.
Yes, we did. Yes. We did. That is quite true.
I don't think Andy knows what a cockatoo is. You know what a cockatoo is, Andy?
Yeah, of course I do.
Well, your father's an SP bookmaker too.
Are we talking about the bird, or...?
We're talking about the bird.
No.
It's that's really funny.
Because nobody would know what a cockatoo is.
So Dad had lots of time.
Yeah.
He was the one who got us off to school, brushed our hair, made our plaits, put ribbons in our hair, made our school lunches.
Obviously he was involved.
Oh, very. Yes, he was. Yes,
you wouldn't think there'd be an SB bookie in Bourne, would you?
There was more than one.
More than one?
There was one, and whose name, I'm sorry, I can't remember, but my sister was on the tram. And this bookmaker, whom she knew, because my sister knew everybody and everything, younger sister, he was hopping off the tram, and he'd left this huge roll of money on the seat.
Yeah, yes.
And my sister raced after him and tapped him on the shoulder.
Says, do you want this?
So there was obviously more than one. Yes, I think there was.
So your dad? Did your mother work, or was she at home?
Oh, she stayed at home. Yes.
So he made a good living.
Well,
Some weeks.
I think it's precarious. It was precarious. See, Dad was in his 50s when he got married. He was a returned soldier from the First World War.
Right.
And he'd worked in logging camps and, all those. Yep. Yeah. And so, I don't know. Look, I think it was variable. See, as you get older and you're an SP bookmaker, it's more nerve-wracking.
Yeah.
Well, because people place bets with you and you've got to cover that.
That's right. And so you
lay off, these bets if they're too big, other bigger bookmakers.
That's right.
And I think as time went by, that was what was happening.
Uh-huh.
And we were pretty, poor.
Right.
But then my dad had this history from his own family. His father was a mine manager in Ballarat.
Right.
And he died and left his 9 children.
Mm-hmm.
And so, of course, they all had to go to work. My father worked at a boot factory when he was 13.
Mm-hmm.
There's a famous photograph. It's in the National Library, of, these men,
mm-hmm,
and
mm-hmm,
with my dad, a little 13-year-old, sitting right in the middle of the front.
As a bootmaker. Honourable profession, bootmaker.
Yes, it was.
Do you know where he fought in the First World War?
Oh, they were in France.
He
started off in Egypt. They all seemed to go to Egypt for training. And then off they went to France.
Did he say much about it, or did he just keep it to himself?
He used to tell us funny stories.
Oh, right.
I think that was his way of coping with it. Mm. Yeah, but his brother followed him to the First World War, and he was a younger brother, and that was really bad for him because he came back very badly affected by the war. Whereas Dad had been in locking camps, and he'd been,
Don't worry about that. That's just a bomb. It's okay.
That's all right.
Let's go. I'll defuse it.
Yes, I'm not worried about bombs.
Yeah.
So he was not so vulnerable, but I think the younger ones, I think it was...
Yeah.
I mean, I think war was a dreadful thing.
Oh, it is.
It's just ridiculous when you think about it.
Right. So where did you go to high school?
Oh, I went to Vaucluse Convent.
Right.
Which was run by the nuns, Faithful Companions of Jesus, FCJs. Uh-huh. Uh-huh. Ran Genizano.
Right.
I think there's still some left.
Where was this? What suburb?
In Richmond.
It was in Richmond.
So
how did you get there from Bourne to Richmond every day?
Oh, on the tram. It was quite simple, the 48 tram, trundles down Bridge Road and whatever, yeah.
So when did you finish high school?
Where?
No, when?
When? 1957.
So what are the options for a young woman in 1957 who's finished year 12?
Teaching, nursing, librarianship, medicine if you were, that clever.
Mm-hmm.
But, I ended up working in the State Library.
Right.
And I was there for about 5 years. That was... that was good. I mean, there were lots of young people there in those days. It was.
So, what did you do at the library?
What did I do there? Mm. Well, we put a lot of books away.
Fair enough.
I worked in the country library, which was fascinating because.
Where was that?
That was in the State Library.
In the State Library. Oh, they had a country library.
Yeah, down in a sort of a add-on building. You know where Mr. Tulk's Cafe is?
Yeah.
Well, that's where I worked physically. That was in that space.
So, what was the country library?
Well, the country library was set up for books, for sending books to people who lived in the country. And Mitcham was the country in those days. Ringwood was the country. All sorts of.
Lilydale would have been the outer.
Yes, probably.
Would have been a foreign city.
But then there were people, right out.
Yeah.
This was because there was no municipal libraries. And eventually the municipal, that was a big movement to get municipal libraries going. So that was good. And then there was actually another library there, which was called the Travelling Library.
Mm.
And that provided books for prisons and for those Dan ships, the Kista Dan, and they were the ships that went to the Antarctic and provisioned Australian and RA
people.
Yeah, did all that. So I didn't work there, but I worked in the country library.
So what made you leave the library in the early 20s?
Your biggest aim in life in the lending library was to be on the inquiry desk. This was, you know, this was the ultimate.
The ultimate.
So this was the ultimate. Well, you know, I did, you know, achieve that.
Yeah.
And then what happened? One of my friends left answering a mysterious advertisement in the paper saying, "Librarians wanted, please contact Dr. Warren."
Mm.
Well, the mysterious Dr. Warren, as it turned out, was Dave Warren, the inventor of the black box flight recorder.
Right.
And the library that he was looking for librarians for was, of course, Aeronautical Research Lab Library. And I just thought this sounded like rather more fun than
the inquiry desk.
Oh, well, I love the inquiry desk. The inquiry desk was, in those days, it was a closed catalogue because people had to come and they had to ask you. You couldn't go and look. And, of course, there was a card catalogue, you know what I mean?
Mm.
And one day I discovered a small child who pulled out the drawer,
right.
Had the drawer on his head.
And the catalogue?
Well, he had to lift it up to get it out, you know. So it was quite safe, but I was a bit worried about him nevertheless, and I rushed over and I said, "Oh, darling, what are you looking for?" And he said, "I'm looking for Snuggle Pot and Cuddle Pie." And one of my friends now, just recently, told me that she thought it was one of the Crean children. She said that Frank Crean used to bring his children in it. And it might have been even Simon Crean. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But he had the right drawer.
He had the
SN drawer. Yes. Right down on the bottom, or left.
Yeah.
You know, so it had its gorgeous moments.
Right.
And another time a man came in and asked me for a bird book, a particular bird book,
mm-hmm.
and I couldn't find it in the catalogue. And he stood his ground. He said, "No, it's got to be here. It must be here somewhere." And I said, "Well, it's not in the catalogue." But I said, "We have got an old catalogue out in the back room," which I had nothing to do with, but apparently it did turn out that people were going through those records and adding them gradually, but they hadn't done it all, you know what I mean, like all those jobs that went on forever, all handwritten in beautiful copperplate. So I went out, fell over a few, you know, all the broken chairs and things that used to be in that room, and there I found the card for the book. And it was in the storeroom, which was Palmer Hall. It was the store where you put your cloak, you know, coats and things. The storeroom. And I came back holding this filthy, dirty leather bound volume, because it was, you know.
Mm.
And he was doing a dance.
A dance?
Yes, he was. Because he could see his book coming. Right. Yeah. So it had its gorgeous moments.
Yes. It's 4:34. This is Radical Australian Community Radio 3CR streaming live on 3CR. .org.au. We are interviewing Madame Annette Cully Donovan. I've got it right.
Donovan Cully or whatever you
whatever,
like.
Whatever.
Whatever.
So you said you had three children. When did all that happen?
Sorry?
You said you had three children. When did that happen? What, after the black box? Or?
Oh, no. Well, I worked there for a few years and met somebody there that, I'm married and I had three children, But in the meantime, I'd worked at, I left ARL. Things went pretty, a bit, you know, there were problems there. And eventually, the whole library staff resigned gradually. En masse. I got a job with the SEC's Research Laboratory, which had just been formed, the Herman Research Laboratory in Richmond, and that was great, you know, because there were men there who couldn't get security clearances because they were from, you know, European countries, and they couldn't prove who they, that they were safe people to work for defence and places like that. So they went to places like, so there were two Hungarians, there were a couple of Russians, That was interesting. Yeah, I like that. And then I left when I had a baby, so that was the end. That place is only just closed. It's only closed down recently.
Right.
That became privatised, and then I don't know what happened. But
So what happened when you had children? Did you withdraw from the workforce? Or?
For a while. Yes, for quite a while.
What's quite a while?
Probably when Justin was at school, I did, because I remember I worked in high school libraries. I just filled in.
Right.
when librarians were away. That was, I loved that. It was, yeah. That was, I liked the teenagers. They were really good. And I think that tapped into things that we had going on in Heathmont. A group of us got together and we weren't happy with the way our children were being taught. Oh, not the teaching so much, but the things that went on in schools weren't all that crash hot in those days, and we became interested in radical school reform.
When was this?
This would be. I'm just trying to think. The 1970s.
Yes. Because things were a little bit ablaze in those days, in the early 70s, late 60s.
Yeah, that's right. There was radical school reform. Do you know about that? Herbert Cole wrote 36 Children. Have you read that?
No, I haven't read that one.
Fantastic book. Yeah, he's. You can go into, on the internet and you can see.
So what did you do this group of people do in Heathmont?
We decided that there was something wrong with the way teachers communicated, basically, and we became interested in Thomas Gordon's parent effectiveness training and teacher effectiveness training, PET and TET, they were called.
Cool,
and so we did a lot of, work on that sort of thing and talking about how to communicate, reflective listening and, all that sort of thing.
Do your children thank you for that, or they just look at you in a funny way?
I think they looked at me in a funny... I think my daughter thought it was hilarious because she came to one session of... I don't know what it was about, but we were, going somewhere to learn something, and she was under the chair laughing her head off. And
how old was she?
She was in primary school.
Oh, right.
I said, oh, were you wondering what that was all about? And she said, yeah, it sure sounded like looking after people or, helping people or something like that. She got the idea of what it was about. But it was quite... See, in those days, we didn't know about that. Mm-hmm. That was quite a powerful tool, that listening. One of my children was going to walk home with a mate, and the mate stood him up. There was only little primary school.
Yes.
And I eventually drove to the school to find him, and he was in a furious mood. He was kicking the seat of the car. And I said, you sure felt bad when Matthew stood you up. And he said, can I have an ice cream? Oh, and that was so beautiful. So, and then, of course, we practiced on each other's children. And we report back, how we'd got on when we babysat and things like that. And then we took ourselves off to the education department psych branch just to check up that what we were doing was, sort of kosher.
All right. Yeah, that and you weren't abusing
your own kids. They were amazed.
You weren't abusing your own kids.
They were amazed at what we were doing. They thought we were, They thought we were pretty wonderful.
You said you went to university. When did that happen?
I've went to university a lot.
A lot? Well, I don't know. What, as a permanent protester?
Yes, it was a sort of, it was an endless process, yeah. Well, it was expected in our family.
Right.
My sister went to teachers' college. Became an infant mistress. I just started, I did a library training course, really. I did that first. And then I went, I did history and philosophy of science. I did fine arts, which was fascinating, and earth science with Derek Mulvaney.
When was that?
He was only there for a couple of years. So that was...
What, the early 80s?
I honestly can't remember. I was there backwards and forwards.
What was he like as a teacher?
Fabulous. Yes, a very lively little man. Right. Yes. I used to see him at Mass, actually.
So you still continued your religious... You still went to Mass, did you?
Oh, I did in those... that's a long time ago.
We won't go there. When did that finish?
Oh, I think when my marriage broke up, actually.
And what year was that?
Oh, 1980.
Waiting. And the kids were, still relatively young when the marriage broke up?
Yeah.
So you were the primary caregiver then, were you?
Oh, yes.
And how hard was it then?
Oh, difficult. Yes, very difficult. Well, I don't know. I think I was a dependent sort of person. Mm-hmm. I'd come from a family where my dad told us what to do, basically. Right. Yep, you know, yep. He'd say to my sister, who was the most reliable, Kamie, Cambria her name is, Kamie, get your pencil, and he'd write down, you know, things we had to do. And, yeah. And so I just thought, you know, when I got married, that I'd be told what to do, I think. So, yeah, well, I mean, it's the children are difficult and money's a problem. And but I think, you know, we had a house and over our head and we owned it and we were paying it off and, you know, and it was an amicable breakup. Yeah, you know. So, that's when I did the work in high school libraries. I also did market research, but I was pretty hopeless at that. You know,
well, are you telling people the answers?
Well, I'd ask people, did they know what osteoporosis was, and they'd say no. So I told them. Yeah. I don't think we were supposed to do that.
No, not in market research.
So that. So that was that.
How old were you when your responsibilities for the children kind of dissipated?
Oh well, I
when they left home.
I'm not sure. It just gradually happened. It gradually happened. Right. And
Don't worry. Look, I look at the watch.
Do you want to talk about this?
Hang on. See, this is what happens, Andy. Put on your microphone. This is what happens. I'll tell you what happens. You get guests come in and they think they're running the show. They've got a point. They don't understand that we get to the point.
Okay.
All right. We still have 19 minutes.
Oh, that's a lot of time. Yes, that's
Donovan Cully. We still have 19 minutes. So relax. We're not interested in you. Yes. Obviously, we're interested in what you're doing. But the last few years of your life isn't your life, is it?
Well,
or is it?
I must say that in about 1975, innocently visited the Ringwood Library.
Yes.
And I picked up a book.
What was it called?
And it was called The People of the Valley.
The People of the Valley.
And it was written by a woman called Wynne Sargent.
Mm-hmm.
And she was a self-styled photojournalist. She came from America. Yep. She was mixed up with some old church, and I can't remember now what. It doesn't matter anyway, but, you know. Yep. And she had already lived with the Dyaks in Kalimantan, Borneo, and she'd set up a fund for, you know, looking after those people. And then Suharto asked her, would she go to West Papua to see what was going on there. And I don't know. So that's strange to me because the Indonesians were the ones causing the trouble there. asked her anyway.
So you saw this book. What was pivotal about this book in your life?
Well, it just struck a chord with me.
Why struck a chord?
I don't know.
I mean, these are people, you know, you wouldn't have even heard about.
Well, I hadn't even heard of them. No. Well, there was something about her, I think. Mm-hmm. You know, she's had a translator with her, an Indonesian girl called Jam.
Mm-hmm. And, so we're talking about West Papua, obviously, people of the Valley.
She went into the Balium Valley, the two of them, and they lived with various groups of people. I mean, they were not a united group of people.
No.
And she discovered what was happening to them with the Indonesian, police and whatever, was brutal, and horrible. And of course, she had to sort of advocate for them then, and that
going back to this, what we'd call a pivotal experience in your life, kind of life changing. Did you act on this in 75? This is a nice book
because there was nothing to act on.
That's right.
But I never stopped telling people about it.
The story,
from the beginning. Right. You know, I'd say, you know, have you heard a place called West Papua? And they'd say, no, where's that? You know,
yeah.
Well, they're still saying, no, where's that?
So This became an important part of your life then, or was it just a book you
read? No, it was just something there in the back of my mind the whole time. I mean, elephants were there too, because I became obsessed with elephants and read some great books about, you know, elephants.
That's the trouble being a librarian, isn't it? You kind of read the books.
Yes, you do.
Yeah, you shouldn't be reading the books. It gives you strange ideas, you know.
They do, don't they? Yes, yes. There's something about books very dangerous.
They are dangerous.
Very dangerous, yeah. So,
Guttenberg should have been
executed. My sister and brother-in-law... My sister and brother, were very involved with in American Indian culture, and my brother Frank Donovan started working out how to make an Indian teepee, like properly, with all the proper dimensions, because they're not round like they look, but they're elliptical, and they're elliptical at the back.
It's strange, isn't it? It really is strange, because a lot of people in that period looked at Indian culture, and we kind of forgot that we had the world's oldest living culture here, under our own feet.
Yes,
it's quite extraordinary.
It is, isn't it?
Because when I started this Tanaminoe Morbohina saga about 12 years ago, even now, you talk to people, they can tell you about Sitting Bull and the Comanches and the Apaches, and you ask them to name one Australian indigenous resistance fighter, and they wouldn't know.
They wouldn't know.
Because of all that television.
Well, do you know what I think it was? Yeah. It was before television, and I think my father loved Zane Grey, and he loved all those books about, American.
Yep.
So I don't know where it
wasn't just your brother, it was everybody. All the kids. We'd all play cowboys and Indians.
Shoot each other with arrows.
I shot my sister in the eye once, She wasn't very happy about it.
Oh, I could have just imagined.
She was about six, I think.
I bet your parents weren't very happy either.
No, luckily it was only the white of the eye, the conjunctivitis. There was no permanent damage, although she still reminds me when she sees me that
I can imagine that she would, yes. But my brother took it to extremes.
He was shooting you too, was he, with the bows and arrows?
At that stage, he worked at the RMIT library, and even though he didn't have a library qualification, I think he was very bright, actually, and he ended up in charge for a while of book purchasing. So apparently the RMIT library has this wonderful collection of books about American and Indians. My brother wonders whether they're still there.
We've done the 80s. What did you do in the 90s? Is this when you were three of the kids?
I went back to university in the 90s because I hadn't finished that degree, and they said I'd have to do it all over again, and I just thought of trying to get to Melbourne University from Heathmont. It was a bit hard. And I thought, I won't do that. And then I saw this course advertised, health promotion, and it was just a new course. And so I'd already done some of that stuff with Denise, Ding Dyson, History and Philosophy of Science. So it was a sort of, in fact, Laurieson Ledger, I think that was his name. Yes, he'd already done that History and Philosophy of Science too with Dyson, and so our first year was a repeat of.
So you did that, and then you went to work in that field.
1995. Yeah. Oh, that was. No, 1992, I was asked, a friend rang me up and said, I've got a library job going, but it's only 4 hours a week and we can't be bothered advertising and going through
like
all that stuff.
It?
Would you like to do it?
Yeah.
I mean, I wouldn't have got a job otherwise, I don't think, because I wasn't computer literate. Yeah. So I said, okay, yes, and that was it. I worked at Caritas Christi Hospice and ran the medical library there for 20 years. 20 years.
What, 4 hours a week?
Oh, no, increased in time,
Tell us about the hospital.
Oh, well, it was going through a change, in fact, from being a place where people sort of who looked like they were going to die, were there for months on end sometimes. Yeah. Look, I don't know, because I'm not a doctor.
No.
I mean,
What does the hospital do? A lot of people wouldn't know what it does.
Oh, so, I'm sorry. Oh, it offers palliative care to people. Now it's moved from being a place where, somebody just goes to die, it's to where, your symptoms are relieved and hopefully you can be sent, go home.
It's basically become
much more scientific, in fact. Yes.
Yeah, but it's more of a facility for people who don't have private health insurance, basically, isn't it?
Oh, no, Look, lots of famous people die there, actually.
Yes. And ordinary people.
Well, yeah, you know, if you're going to die, you know where to go, Luke.
Exactly. Going back, so when did this West Papuan adventure, when did you reconnect?
Well, when the East Timor thing happened in 1999 and... Mm-hmm. I went to a mass at St Patrick's Cathedral. I think Louise had something to do with organising that, actually. Wow. And so did one of the nuns from Caritas, actually.
Right. Yes.
And that was so spectacular. It was really, you know, they blew the horn, yep, turned the lights out. You know, yep, it was all...
Yep.
And sang Solidarity Forever, which was great. And I just thought, well, I don't understand West Papua. I don't know what's going on there.
Yep.
So I'll find out about East Timor.
Mm-hmm.
So now I have piles and piles of books everywhere
Timor. How long did this love affair for East Timor last?
Well, from 1999 until, but this was always the first thing, you see.
Yeah,
this was what inspired me to find out about East Timor.
Yeah.
I don't know whether I would have done that.
If
I hadn't read The People of the Valley, and I thought, well, if I know what the end... Yes. Well, the first book I read, of course, was, you know, Michelle Turner's Telling East Timor. Have you read that book?
Yes. Now going back to East Timor now, when did you kind of fade away from that?
Well, when it started to look like, you know, I got involved with the Alola Foundation.
Yes.
And, you know, I gave them some money every now and then and worked on stalls, and I was hopeless at that anyway. I was giving people the wrong change and stuff like that.
So when did you...
I could see that I was a bit superfluous. You know, there wasn't a place, do you know what I mean?
Yeah, and then, so when did you then get involved with the West Papua Independence Movement?
In 1990... 2009. March 2009, and it was a day where it was Saturday and it teemed with rain. And then I went in, I'd heard on the grapevine that something was happening in the city, but I didn't know what the something was and the something turned out to be...
So you're the type of person, Annette, that will go to something happening in the city?
Well, I didn't know what it was, you see. I knew it was about West Papua.
You knew it was about West Papua, right.
Yes, I did.
Right.
So it turned out to be Adolf Mora and Ricky Rumbiak handing out very badly roniated little leaflet things about West Papua. So I said, oh, look, I know about this and give me some and I'll hand them out too.
Right.
So I did that and that's where it started.
Right.
Yes, because I had no connection, you see, with any West Papuan.
So what was it like in the early stages with the West Papua?
Well, we spent a lot of time shouting Merdeka outside the Indonesian consulate.
Right.
And I don't know what that did, but it was great and, you know, there was lots of singing and... Mm-hmm. Shouting Merdeka and Herman Wongai, he shouting out a lot of stuff that I couldn't understand.
But, right.
To the consulate. I don't know what notice they took of all that, but
they always take notice.
Yes, I think they did. That went on for a long time, and then one night I went to a film night, I think, and it was at Kindness House, and there was a lovely-looking woman with long red hair, and she was doing coffee. And I just watched her, and she was so professional, and she was so dedicated. And I thought, oh, I would love to meet this person, but, oh, she wouldn't want to be... She wouldn't be interested in me, you know.
Right.
And then on the 1st of December, 2011, we were somehow together at the 8-Hour Monument.
Yes,
and that was, you know...
For the West Papuan
For the West Papuans. And there was a lot of people there. There was, you know, that was a bit of a big thing.
Yeah.
And
so what are you doing now?
Well...
With the West Papuan Independence Movement.
Well, I've written that book. And
well, I don't think anybody can see it.
Sorry?
I don't think anybody can see the book.
How do you mean?
We're talking about it. We can't...
they can't see the book.
They can't see the book. And they're funny people. They're like
I'm sorry.
They don't have X-ray vision. We only have X-ray vision. It's the people in here that are...
It's
so what's
West
the book?
West Papua, Decolonisation, Boundaries and Self-Determination. So...
When did you write that?
Over the last 2 years, 2014, 15.
Right, right.
Yeah. Well, somebody asked me, Louise actually asked me, Jacob wanted to know, did I know anything about boundaries? And I said, no, not a thing. Right. I'll look it up on Wikipedia. And Louise wanted me to concentrate on fisheries. And
they're people involved with the West Papuan office.
Yes, that's
they,
right.
Louise?
Yes, sorry.
Yeah.
And so I got a bit tired of, you know, the Torres Strait and fisheries and, you know, things like that, because I think that's always his background, like his anthropology type of thing.
Yep, yep.
And I started to say, well, hang on, what actually happened? What does international law say about all this, you know? And then I knew that the Indonesians claimed something called uti possidetis, which was a Latin word that... arose like in the Roman era, going back a long time ago, and it was when somebody owned a house and went on holidays and somebody else took the house over. there was sort of like a kerfuffle when the actual owner of the house came back. So uti possidetis was something, an interdict that said both parties have to stay where they are. You know, one person has to stay in the house, the other person has to stay outside the house and hopefully don't fight with each other, right? And then the magistrate sorted the case out later.
Now, there are a few things coming up. What's coming up in the next few days, the next few weeks?
Well, I think you'll have to tell me about that because
I've
done terribly.
Well, I think the main thing...
Well,
there's the flag raising on the 1st of December,
which is
the West Papua Day.
Mm-hmm.
And then some of the West Papua people come and join us at the Eureka celebrations in Ballarat from 4 a.m. to 10 p.m. That's on Saturday the 3rd of December.
Yeah, right.
And there's the Simpari Art Exhibition, which will be on soon at the ACU Art Gallery at 26 Brunswick Street, Fitzroy.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a big debate, they tell me, on Thursday the 8th of December, between yes and no, by the Monash Association of Debaters, which is MAD, the Melbourne University Debating Society, MUDS, should West Papua be independent? And Monash said yes, and Melbourne says no, so that should be a good night. There's all these cartoonists who have donated their cartoons to be shown at the Simpari Art Exhibition at the ACU Art Gallery, 26 Brunswick Street, Fitzroy, from Friday the 2nd of December 2016 to Sunday the 11th. And then there's the West Papuan Rent Collective Christmas Do, which is on Sunday the 11th of December at the ACU Art Gallery. So if you're a member of the West Papuan Rent Collective, you'll get an invitation. If not, turn up on the day, 1 p.m. Will we be seeing you there?
Possibly, yes.
Possibly?
I've got to work out, you know, there's quite a lot of things going on there.
Wow, well, you're 76, you'd have a lot of time up your sleeve, wouldn't you?
Yes, but I've got a disease, you know. I've got Hashimoto's thyroiditis.
Oh, that's...
And it's horrible, yes.
It is horrible, Hashimoto's thyroiditis.
How do you know about it?
Well, you may find this hard to believe, but I've been a doctor for 40 years. That's why I knew about poor old Dr. Semmelweis.
Yes, I did wonder about that too.
Well, Annette Cully.
Most people haven't heard of...
No, they should.
Yes.
Thank you, Annette Cully Donovan. Thank you for coming in to 3CR on Radical Australia. It was a pleasure talking to you, and hopefully you've got another 16 to 20 years ahead of you being active. Forget about the Hashimoto's thyroiditis. Keep it under control. Keep working. You'll be great. You are great. Yeah. Not will be. You are a wonderful, wonderful example to younger Australians. And thank you very much for making the time to come and see us.
That was a pleasure. Yes.
All the best. Thank you very much, Andy.
Andy was wonderful too.
Ah, thank you. Cheers.
Are we off air?
That the dice are loaded, everybody rolls with their fingers crossed. Everybody knows the war is over. Everybody knows the good guys lost. Everybody knows the fight was fixed. The poor stay poor, the rich get rich. That's how it goes.